Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's November 3rd, 2019, and welcome to episode 202 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
Will I ever find... The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, audio shenanigans while we try to stream, and other such things. Anyway, whatever. I'm Paul Hegstrom in Boston, and on YouTube. I'm joined today by Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you?
Hello, Paul.
Hello.
I waved at Paul because it makes great audio.
Yes, if we were, we are attempting to stream the recording of this as it goes, and that is going to be completely distracting, I am sure. But so also joining me to just above me is Jack Nutting in Stockholm.
Yes, hello, Paul. Yes, I am just above you.
Yes. And also joining us from Portland is Earl Evans, who has forgotten his webcam.
That's right. So I'm joining anonymously.
That's right.
As far as we know, it's Earl.
At any rate, yes. So this we're trying this streaming experiment to see if that is interesting. So we can actually, you can participate as we record, in principle. If it turns out that this just makes for terrible audio, maybe we'll stop doing this.
No, we will not.
This is a lot of fun.
It's kind of fun.
I feel like I'm on the Hollywood Squares.
That's right. Yeah. Is that still a thing? Does that still exist?
Almost certainly it is not.
Probably not.
But we are a retro podcast, yes. So
that's
it's
right.
All good.
We are old and remember these things.
Jack Nutting for the win.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so I'm the host, and there is a host topic. And the host topic was provided by Brian on Facebook some time ago. It is to mod or not to mod with respect to vintage hardware. So people post videos where they do, modifications of their computers. Maybe you have done some in the past. Sometimes people will retrobyte things. And often people will get downvoted for those if they do something non-reversible. What do you think about that sort of mod? Reversible, non-reversible? What do you think of retrobyte? All kinds of things we could talk about. Many of the things we have talked about, I think, before, but not in exactly this form. So, what do we think? I don't know. Earl, what do you think about this? You said you had some thoughts.
Well, I do. If you're talking about Retrobrite, then you're probably talking about a computer case that has yellowed quite badly. And so the worst you're going to do is just come up with a patchwork or something like that, right? I mean, it's a non-reversible modification, I suppose, but the worst that's going to happen is that you're going to make things kind of weird, but you're probably not going to make them any worse. I'm okay with retrobriting. If you're talking about making mods to the computer that are going to permanently change it, like drilling holes in the case or making changes to the main board or something like that, then I guess my opinions are mixed. So I think it was Randy off of Floppy Days just a while back that was talking about an Atari 800 he had that he had really modded like crazy, but then found himself wanting just a generic Atari 800, so he had to get another one. So I guess that's the thing too, is how rare is the computer that you're modding? If you're modding something like a Commodore 64 or an Atari 800, something like that where there's a lot of them, it's probably okay. If you're modding something that is really rare, really collectible, and, there's only so many of them and you're going to basically change it forever, then I might think twice about doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they can, you know, like some of the mods can make things such that you can use them. I mean, like, you know, so a modern modification that allows you to, you know, so you don't have to use channel 3 on your, you know, VHF TV. You know, it depends on whether what the future of this device is. If the future of this device is you are going to use it to play your games or whatever, not give it to a museum or, I don't know, demo it, then it sort of seems like it's better to be able to use it than not. So, I don't know. Carrington, what do you think?
I'm going to have unpopular opinions because that's what I do. That's what I bring to this roundtable. I rail against the fact that I don't own most of the things I own. On Twitter recently, I think it was with Benj or somebody, we were talking about how when you buy Apple movies online, sometimes you just can't play them if you don't have an active credit card, or like you don't really own anything you buy anymore because of DRM, because of not being able to modify stuff in various ways, things being locked down. And I rail against that. I really don't like that. I want the right to be able to destroy anything I own. I became interested in tech because I took apart my family's electronics that I did not own and I ruined them and I got in trouble for it. But still, it made me the person I am today. And I like the guy I am today. I'm awesome. So I think people... Like, if it comes down to, like, should you mod things or not, I think you shouldn't mod other people's stuff without letting them know. Like, I shouldn't sneak into Earl's house and mod his stuff. So I'm gonna take a hard pass on that. But I think even if something is incredibly rare, too bad you own it, do anything you want with it. I might not want you to if it was the last thing in the world and it's something that I was hoping to possess, but if I'm not going to possess it from you, what do I care what you do with it? Like, if... Like, so it's kind of one of those, it's none of my business things. I'm interested in retro computer body autonomy is, I guess, the stance I'm taking. I think you should go ahead and destroy anything. And other nerds, especially collectors, and you can look behind me and see what kind of a collector I am, are going to be upset at you regardless because you're not doing the thing that they think you should do with the stuff that you have. And too bad. Who cares? I think it's perfectly fine to mod something. I think it's perfectly fine to gut it. I think it's perfectly fine to do that even if it's rare. And too bad. Do it for the clicks. Do it for the lols. Do it for whatever. If it makes you happy, maybe you'll do it and regret it. But that's on you. That's like getting a tattoo. I got a tattoo. I'm trying to show you. I can't. Where's my camera? I swear, this is a tattoo. You just can't see it. There, twist. There. But I don't regret it. But maybe I would have. Yeah, too bad. In my arm, my business. So I think you should mod the heck out of anything you want, even if it's rare. Some of my eBay choices I'll be picking for later in the show include a couple of options. Like, here's a thing that's rare. Here's, like, another version of it that's not rare in case you want to mod it. So it's kind of interesting that this topic came up. But curmudgeonly, I think anybody should go ahead without hesitation and mod the heck out of everything on whim. Because interesting stuff can come from it. So there.
Well, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. The way you interpreted the question was different than I did. I didn't interpret the question as, should I or should I not mod it based on what the retro community thinks? I kind of interpreted the question as, should I or should I not mod it based on whether I'm going to regret it in the future, whether I'm going to look at that and go, ooh, that was a rare XYZ 102, and I can never find another XYZ 102, and now
but
I just...
How will you know what you'll regret? That's the future.
Well, you don't know. You don't
right.
know.
So go ahead and mod. Do it. Right now. Get your camera working, Earl, and mod some stuff for us.
Yeah. Yeah, at least get the camera working first.
Mod your camera.
Yeah. Jack, what do you think?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm pro modding stuff in general, and for me, one of the main reasons is, I mean, back in the day when we had computers that weren't as powerful as they are now, like, we did mod things, right, to make things better. Like, that was, I remember when I was in, like, junior high, and, like, that was kind of whenever I would discuss with my friends who had Apple IIs, like, that was sort of their whole point of, yeah, this computer is way more expensive than your computer, but, look, I can open up the case, I can put cards in, I can do things to it pretty easily. And like, I know that my first Atari 400, once I started using it, I realized, oh, this thing is kind of unusable. I've got to actually put in a keyboard that actually works, and I've got to add some more RAM so that I can use it. And like, if I had access to a good composite monitor at the time, and there was a readily available mod that would let me add a composite output to that, I would have done it in a heartbeat. Like, not no question. So to me, it's like modding things to make them work better with the environment that you're in now only makes it more useful to you, and also it gives it a bit of a story, and it gives it a bit of an interesting thing. And it's sort of like I see now and then people posting, "Oh, I picked up an Atari, you know, whatever, and how to make it work with my modern LCD TV." And often the answer is, "Well, you can't. Like, if all it has is RF output, that signal's too weak. A lot of TVs won't pick it up these days. Maybe you don't even have a TV that has an RF input. Like, who knows?"
Okay, I have a question for you, Jack. Though, what about modding it not to be more useful, but like gutting it for an art project? What about getting an old Macintosh and ripping out all the insides, throwing them out, and making an aquarium or an art piece or something like that kind of mod? What about mods that don't make it more functional in a traditional way, but sort of literally destroy it or make it into something else?
I think that's fine. What's your stance on that? I think that's fine too, because you're at least doing it with the intention of making something that is interesting in some way, at least to you. Whereas consider how many old Macs have just been thrown away, have just been completely discarded, you know, apart from being gutted, just like actually been like smashed and ripped to pieces and gone. Like, it's better to take something and, okay, if this thing is broken and I don't have a good use for it besides making an aquarium, then like, why not? Go ahead. And again, I think, yeah, it does. I tend to hew a bit towards what Earl's saying. Like, if it is like the only one, then that might be a shame. But like, how often is that we have the only one of something? All these things that are rare cost tens of thousands of dollars. So I'm not going to make that rare thing into an aquarium, probably. But again, well, what you're saying also, Carrington, if I wanted to, if I paid the money for it and I want to turn it into an aquarium, fine.
Even if the nerds will be angry at you?
Yeah, even if. I
shake our little nerd fists.
Screw them.
You know, I mean, I guess...
I really thought I was going to be the only one taking the stance. I might change my stance.
One kind of circumstance that this can happen in, where I'm not so comfortable with it, is if the person who's doing it, you know, so like making an aquarium or making a YouTube video to try to get clicks by destroying something, mm-hmm. you know, or whatever. If the person who's doing it doesn't really understand what they have, that I think is a little distressing, you know. Mm-hmm. So like there's one video that I've seen at some point. I almost have shut it out of my mind because I don't want to think about it. But it was basically someone like took a 2E, you know, or something, and like smashed it with a hammer or something like that. You know, I was like, well, all right, that's cool. But the problem is that inside it was a very rare card, and the kid had no idea. Right. You know, I mean, they didn't. You know, this is like grandpa's old computer or whatever. Mm-hmm. Not, you know, considered to be junk and, you know, more entertaining to hit with a hammer. And
the computer, not grandpa.
Right.
just for clear.
Right. It was the computer. However, but I mean, so it would be one thing if the kid knew, all right, I have this rare card, I'm going to break it for the clicks, you know, rather than, you know, I have this piece of garbage. It doesn't matter. Nobody wants any of these things anyway. You know, my watch does more. So that kind of rides the line. I mean, like, I sort of feel like at least if the person knew what they were doing, then okay, whatever. That's their thing to do. I can be a little sad. I suppose I'm not sure that I can be angry. I can click sadly on the downvote button.
It's kind of like whenever a few years ago when Apple released some new iPhone that people found, oh, this phone can bend and break easily. I think it was like the 6 Plus or whatever. People were like, hey, I have my phone in my back pocket, and suddenly it bent and the case opens up. And I remember there was a YouTube video shortly after that where somebody who had enough money to burn just like bought one of these phones and just like proceeded to bend it on camera until it broke. And it's sort of the line between that, like they knew what they were doing. It was not like a question, and they had the budget for it. And I'm sure it was for the clicks, right? They know they're going to get the money back, right? So, but it's the line between that and seeing someone who has a brand new phone that they just like casually drop into a storm ditch, like, or like, you know, just don't, like, what is this? I don't even know.
Yeah.
I think I'm probably closer to your position than you think, though, Carrington, because I was thinking, you know, about my eBay auction that we'll talk about later is actually where somebody has taken a retro item and has completely changed the aesthetic of it. So it didn't actually make it more functional. It didn't destroy it, but on the other hand, it completely changed it. So you've got this thing that, you know, now is different, like forever. And I looked at that and I was like, oh, that is so totally cool. That looks cool. So, you know, I'm okay with doing that mod if it makes it better for you.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I guess my problem is, in general, this hobby, like a lot of things that I like, has so much gatekeeping in it. So many people calling others fake geeks, fake whatever. And so I guess I get my back up instantly when somebody's saying, oh, you shouldn't do that because, like, you don't know it as much as I do. You do, like, so I guess I get, I don't know. I see myself sitting in such a position of privilege sometimes that I'm like, well, hold on. Like, how do I know what other people should do? I shouldn't have the right to tell somebody what to do. But at the same time, I realize a lot of my urges come from this need for chaos, right? So of course I'm advocating to destroy and mod things because, like, that's like, I'm a force of chaos. And I think what I've done is convince you all it's okay to destroy your own collections, which on the next show we should do live on camera.
That's right.
It's sledgehammer time.
Excellent. At the same time, though, I think people shouldn't be, it's like I believe in free speech, but I don't believe that that means you don't have any consequences from what you do. So same thing, like you can destroy a thing and you should totally have the right to do that. But if your YouTube comments are then filled with people pointing out that you're an idiot and you just wasted $100,000, well, that's on you, man. Like, too bad. So I don't think there should be consequence-free actions. I just think there should be free actions.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of times just even apart from the outside opinion, I fight with this, you know, just looking at my own things, trying to decide, like, what are the odds that I'm going to successfully make this mod and then not wish that I couldn't. So any kind of reversible thing I like a lot better. But
that's a good point.
I don't know. Are there more things we should say about this? Maybe we've kind of covered the bases.
Well, I will say one more thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a retro computer and unmodded, you're not going to use it. It's just going to sit in a corner for 7 years, gather dust, get all closet rotted. You're going to take it out someday and turn it on. It doesn't work anymore because, you know, cosmic rays and stuff. I would rather see somebody mod their computer and use it and have fun with it for those years rather than just have it sit in the corner because that thing's no fun to use. I don't want to wait 2 hours to load something from tape or, you know, whatever. So, yeah.
Or type on an Atari 400.
Right. Well, and the Atari 400 is an interesting one, too, because that was a mod that people made back in the day, not just modern. I mean, there were all kinds of aftermarket keyboards for the Atari 400. So, I don't know. If you're doing that, you're probably not doing something that is that different than what we did in the 80s, but that's a whole other story. But I'm just saying, if you're not going to use it, if it's just going to sit there and you're going to regret, you know, that loss of fun later, then yeah, mod the heck out of it.
Cool. Okay. I just realized that it's me that's supposed to talk next. So, okay. So we'll leave the topic there, but if you have other thoughts or further agreement with Carrington, you can email us.
Or disagreement, which is much more fun. I'd love to hear somebody, like if a listener has done a mod that they regret, I'd love an example of that because maybe it'd be easier for me to understand if I could like get a concrete example. Or if somebody's done a mod that they didn't necessarily regret but then went like horribly wrong, that'd be a fun story too. Like they modded something and it resulted in complete destruction or embarrassment. I want to hear your embarrassing stories.
That's right. Yeah. The house burned down and took the whole division with it.
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay, let's see. So we also have some listener feedback. I haven't been exhaustive in gathering it, so I have a few things that I collected, and there are more, and we'll get to those later. But the ones that I collected, Dominic wrote over email to tell us about the military no longer using 8-inch discs, and that makes perfect sense. We talked about that last time, but that previous episode is not on the feed yet. So,
I thought that sounded familiar. I'm like, wait, didn't we talk about this? Yes, we did.
We did. Jack and I both tried to put it in the, we will have talked about this.
Excellent.
Jason wrote over email to say that, he's been sort of catching up. You can sort of tell at what era he's been catching up in because he says we talk about lemons a lot.
I remember that period.
That's right. It's our lemon phase. But also, he does a bunch of interesting stuff in the Atari 8-bit world. And I don't know, Jack, if you had a chance to look at this and if you know some of these things, but he's written a How Not to Learn Assembler column in the latest edition of Pro C Atari magazine. Do you know Pro C?
Yes. Well, I know it enough that I don't know if it's called Pro C or Proc. There's been discussion about this. I'm familiar with the magazine. I haven't seen this, though. I'm just looking at this email right now, actually. Yeah, so I can't really say any more about this specifically, unfortunately.
Sure. But it is, He says it's a 100-page printed Atari magazine in 2019, so that's cool.
That is very cool. Although I think from looking at my personal history, I think I already know how to not learn assembler.
Yeah. I've been practicing for years. But yeah, so he says he's also written his fourth 6502 assembler game. So in 6502 assembler, the fourth of these, not in fourth.
Hmm.
A scrolling platformer, block on legs, first steps.
Very impressive.
Oh, I see.
Very nice.
Yeah. So we'll have a link to the PROC or Pro-C Atari magazine in the show notes. And he also runs the 8-bit Atari High Score Club on Atari Age. So you may well have run across him in various ways. Thank you for listening. And
yes, this
go check out all of Jason's things.
Jason is the real Bounty Bob on Atari Age. A username that I do recognize. So.
Oh, okay. Bounty Bob is the minor 2049er person, right?
That's right.
Cool. Let's see. Kevin wrote over email to tell us about a Sega light gun replacement that that he made in the spirit of the Terminator movies. And it works. I don't have the link up in front of me, but it's it works on a T2 game or something like that. And so I didn't watch it all the way through, but apparently it is something that you can use to... you know, to use the light gun on an LCD display.
Excellent. So. Nice. Because, yeah, that's one of the downsides to most of those is they will only work on old CRTs. So that's very cool.
Yep. He's made a really cool video where he shows how it works and stuff. A lot of interesting diagrams of how things
work.
It's very, very nice. And it also looks really badass. It's a very cool thing he's made. So
he also mentioned in his email that he's listened to every show multiple times. The pain that must have caused, I don't know, but we're impressed at least. Yep. I'm not sure if delighted or not, but thank you for listening, though, and for writing in. It is a neat thing. I'm looking forward to actually watching that video through. Okay, anyway, so that's what I've marked down in the listener feedback category. I will try to catch up on the backlog. We have a couple of months of backlog that I haven't fully caught up on. But now we can turn to the items of interest and news. And Carrington, you have the first one.
The first one is a game, a new game for the Apple II, which is always very exciting. This is called Spell Wielder, and it's published by, I love this name, Crow Cousins, which is a terrific name, and they have a terrific logo. It's donationware, so you can go online and grab it right now and then give up a few bucks if you like it. It's an open-ended action-adventure game, so you get to walk around big open world and cast spells and fight a big boss eventually, and super, super, super cool. I have downloaded it, but I've not yet played it, so can't give a full-on review, but there's a video on the site we'll link to, the Crow Cousins site, that shows you some image or some video of what the gameplay looks like, and it looks totally sweet and with really cool graphics, and it can be played by joystick or keyboard, and it's Mockingboard compatible and everything, so this is a hardcore, very cool game out for the Apple II. Hooray for new games.
Very interesting.
I clicked the video. It looks really neat.
Yep, and you have to answer riddles. There's a typing thing that says it's speak, which is used to answer riddles. I'm like, that is very enticing. I think this is going to be a very awesome game, and I am very much looking forward to playing it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I it's always kind of neat when someone puts together something this large scale new.
Right, and the Crow Cousins site and their logo and everything about it has a real feel of the old Beagle Brothers stuff, that old fashioned kind of look. There's a Beagle Brothers style. All the Crow Cousins stuff seems to have that kind of feel to it, and so that endeared me to it right away.
Oh, you're right. I just hit play on the video and I see that the That is definitely borrowed,
yep.
I can say, from the Beagle Brothers logo. Or it might be Beagle Bros. I'm not sure.
I always used to say Beagle Bros, actually. I don't know where Beagle Brothers came from. Trying to ask you guys.
I keep saying Beagle Brothers.
Beagle Bros.
Whenever I say it, but it's never written that way.
Hmm.
I mean, it's always B-R-O-S dot.
Actually, I don't know how often I've pronounced it out loud, now that I come to think of it. I don't even know how I say it. Who knows what I say?
You walk around the grocery store saying, "This is my Beagle Brothers bag." No one hears you.
This is my boomstick. Right, exactly. Will you be my friend? So far, answer is resounding silence.
All right. Okay. Let's see. Jack, you have the next thing. More 6502. I think it's like 6502 all the way through here.
Yeah, that's just our whole thing. I'm actually gonna try something. I'm gonna try hitting share screen on this. So,
all right. Fancy man,
this is gonna be nuts. Are you guys ready for this?
Yeah. Prepare yourself, audio listeners.
Okay, so Team 6502 is a website focused on, guess what? The team that built the 6502. And it looks kind of interesting. I think it's maybe not quite done. I feel like it's a work in progress, but there are a lot of cool pictures of people and circuit diagrams and things. There are little bios of certain members of the team talking about what they did. There are a few things I know that under like Chuck Peddle, it included some links to a couple of YouTube videos and things. It looks pretty interesting. And there's also a shop. So on the shop, you can like buy some nice 6502 t-shirts and hoodies and tote bags and laptop cases. And it's all very exciting.
That's cool.
And so anyway, it's kind of nice. There's like some nice graphics and things. And as I'm scrolling through, yeah, again, photos of people involved and pictures of CPUs. There's a picture of some famous Apple people down here. And yeah, it's good. I think in here there's kind of an open call here. They would like to get more stories and more people and find out more about what happened. So like if there are people who were involved or who have family members who were involved, I think these people would love to hear about it. So anyway, that was just a cool thing that popped up that I found that I think our listeners will appreciate.
Yeah, well, so, and you can buy stuff from there, right? You said so. Like, this may also be a good place for gift ideas.
Yeah, absolutely.
Given that I don't think we actually have one this time.
Yeah, there are t-shirts and posters and coffee mugs and tote bags and all sorts of things.
Very cool.
Pretty nice.
All right, let's see. So, my thing is next here. So this is it's a thread about basically porting Doom to the Acorn BBC Master. I don't know too much about this, but I do know that I think this might actually also work on the BBC Micro. Yeah. I think the Acorn Master is something separate, right? There's a more, slightly more advanced one. I don't know. I'm not too up on these models, but one thing that they were good at, even at the time, was that they have sort of like built-in architecture for a second processor, so you can put in a coprocessor, and so I think you could get like a 68,000 for them, and you know, like there was like a designated way that was supposed to work. I think they were pretty rare, the things that actually allowed it to work.
Okay.
So what has been done here essentially is that someone took that architecture and connected it to like a modern ARM chip, so that what eventually ended up being possible to do is to actually play Doom on BBC Master or BBC Micro. So that is pretty wild. So the link I have is for, it's sort of a post on retrocomputingforum.com, but I think in there there's a link to a thread on, what's the name of this place? The place where all of this stuff happens, star.org.uk, that's right. So that's where the forum is for much of the kind of like BBC Micro stuff. And there's a thread there talking about like how to do it. And there's also a development thread sort of showing somebody having the idea and then working through it until it is a reality. So I thought that was pretty cool. And it was, this is quite recently posted. So 12 days ago.
That's very
cool. Now you can run Doom on your
phone. We should point out the StarDot thing is another one of those terrible names.
Well, yeah,
it's not star.org.uk. It's StarDot, D-O-T spelled out, .org. So it's star.org.uk. We think ahead in picking that name. Anyway, nice. We'll have links in the show notes, so you don't have to type anything. But don't listen to what we say. General rule, don't listen to what we say.
Okay. And so, Carrington... you are next.
You had very little time to get ready. I'm going to talk about the new type, terrible name for what I think is a terrible thing. So if you like mechanical keyboards, and you should, because the clack, 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 clack lets people know that you're a serious writer doing serious things and makes no one else be able to work around you. I love it. I miss old keyboards like that. I think I've used flat keyboards now so long that I wonder if I can go back, but I do longingly look at mechanical keyboards, but not this one. This is a thing. If you want a mechanical keyboard, but you want to be a total hipster at a cafe, then this is the product for you. Newtype. It's a mechanical keyboard designed ideally to start with to work with a MacBook or MacBook Pro. It's sized to properly overlay the keyboard on your MacBook. So, and it's got little T's that kind of stick down, so they'll tuck between the keys, and that'll the keys on the MacBook, so it holds it in place, and then it sticks up a couple of centimeters. So you have this, you can't close the lid anymore. You just got this big floating mechanical keyboard that sits on top of your computer. The advantage of using this over just putting any old keyboard just on top of your computer, I have no idea. But you can put this over top of your keyboard and then bang away. It's currently a Kickstarter thingy, but I think it was funded. It might be the kind of thing that you want to wait to come out later. Showing on the screen now, I don't know if you can see it or not, I've scrolled down to that it's 42% shorter than standard mechanical key switches. Now, I think one of the big points of a key switch was that long motion. So they're saying what we've done is take away about half of the advantage of a mechanical keyboard, but you still get that big thick thing sticking on top of your keyboard. So it's an interesting device that's kind of targeted towards people that are old school and the keyboard needs. So I think it's got a retro element to it. But I don't know that this is something like actually useful. Like maybe I'm wrong. Maybe if I got a hold of one of these and laid it down on top of my computer at a cafe and I clanked away on my mechanical keyboard, I would like the solitude of everyone else having left. I don't know. But what I found interesting about this and that I want to bring up, because it's a mechanical keyboard thing, and I think a lot of our listeners are probably interested in mechanical keyboards, forget its primary use. That is silly. Sticking on top of your keyboard in bed. Like I got some photos of people, like it's ridiculous. Forget that. But it can sync to multiple devices. So you now have a Bluetooth mechanical keyboard, albeit a flat one, that can sync to up to three devices. So you could pair it with your computer, you could pair it with a laptop, and pair it with your phone and switch back and forth between them. So that's kind of nice. And I wonder if maybe something like this as a keyboard paired to a tablet to make it a portable. So instead of placing it on top of a laptop, you just use it as the keyboard paired to an iPad or an Android tablet and use that as a mechanical keyboard enabled laptop. That might have some interest to our listeners. So that's the main reason I actually brought it up, is perhaps that would be useful. Is that more useful than just any old mechanical keyboard with Bluetooth? I don't know. I suspect not, but it's a new device. It's got mechanical in its name, and so I'm bringing it up, and we're going to have links. And then you can mod it, because we say that's okay to do.
That's right.
Cool. It's interesting. When I first saw it, I thought what this was doing was actually that when you hit the keys, it was pressing the keys beneath it, and I was like, oh my God, this is so terrible.
I would have been on board with that. That would have been amazing.
But you know,
why use your own fingers? Don't have your fingers touch it.
It worked so terribly, but like, but having seen it, it's like, okay, this is something. And what I wonder about, it talks about the height of the keys being 42% smaller. It doesn't say that the travel distance is smaller. Maybe the key moves just as far. It's just that the overall package is smaller. Don't know.
I love it.
I hope so.
I like it.
That would be nice.
I hope so too, because it could just be like thinner plastic or something like that. Nice. Cool. That's a good point. I had thought of that. Excellent.
Did you notice the price of this at all in your...
Million dollars, but they're hipster dollars, so I don't think they correspond to real things. I don't know. Up here, USD, I can switch to Canadian. Doesn't tell me how much. Let's add it to the cart. I have no idea. I have no idea how to buy this thing.
Nope. Well, the Kickstarter campaign is coming soon, so maybe it actually...
Oh, that's why. Okay.
Maybe it actually isn't even available at all.
I would like to point out that I think Earl's got the whole streaming thing working, right? Like, it's actually showing my tab?
It is. I see it.
It is.
Yeah.
Yep.
Earl,
I figured
well
it out.
Well done, you.
Very cool, this StreamYard thing. And the keyboard. Everything is cool.
Yes. All right. So I guess we can move on to the next cool thing. Still 6502, but different platform. So.
Yeah. So this popped up for me on YouTube. Somebody was showing that there is a Commodore 64 program hidden on a vinyl LP as an Easter egg that somebody made 35 years ago. So basically, you know, when you're on an old vinyl record, when you play past the songs, there's like the section where the needle goes in towards the middle, towards the paper label, and then kind of stops and usually automatically goes back up. So down in there, there's a certain spot where past that section, where I think they call it like they call it the run out or something, the spot after the songs. If you can actually have a record player where you can force the arm to not back up and go back to the beginning again, or go off to the side, you can actually put it onto a groove that is past that. And somebody did this and pulled the data off this, digitized it onto a cassette, or actually, no, they just recorded it up from the LP onto a cassette, and they were able to pop that into a data set and load it into a C64. Kind of neat. It's not like a very, it's a very small program. I think it's less than a 1K. It's a pretty small thing. And it was just kind of like an Easter egg for the band. This was a Christian rock band called Prodigal.
Was it a literal Easter egg?
Yeah. So they had an album called Electric Eye that contained this. And the guys in the band didn't write this. Like, they had a friend or they knew somebody who could do this for them. And so whoever did this, whoever made this video said they also tracked down one guy in the band who said, like, he had not seen this program running since the record was pressed. So, kind of cool.
That's pretty wild.
Kind of cool old thing. Like, I've heard of things like programs being broadcast on the radio that you could record onto your audio tape and then play on your computer back in the 80s. But I've never heard of a program being pressed into vinyl. It's pretty interesting. It's a pretty fun video.
Yeah, that's cool. I haven't watched it. I will have to watch it. There used to be, at least for a little while, these like flexi discs that would come with, I forget, there was a magazine that had them. Interface Age maybe had a couple of these where, you know, it would be just like a word processing program in BASIC or something that you, you had this like square, you know, floppy record.
Right.
I think you had to put something heavy on it so that it didn't like fly away.
Right. Well, this was an actual honest-to-goodness vinyl LP by a band, and they just had a wild idea. Let's stick a C64 program at the end of our album.
That's right. And see if anyone ever sees it.
Yep.
And they'd come to the realization that probably nobody ever would until...
Right.
That would be, it'd be so fun to find.
Well, the other interesting thing is, I'm not sure that a Commodore user would even know what a C64 program sounds like, because the way that the data set connects up to the Commodore, you never hear the audio of the program coming through. So, yeah, it's interesting this was ever even found at all.
Yeah, true. And when
the pirates.
In this YouTube video, when they played back that sound, like, it did not sound like anything I've heard. I mean, it's, you know, characteristically similar to like the Atari cassette sounds in a way, in the sense that it is, you know, ridiculous, unintelligible screeching, but it was a different tonal quality than...
That sounds like track two, right?
Yeah. So, anyway, it was kind of fun. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, excellent. That's cool. All right, I guess, so the next thing I have is just, it's barely anything, but it was making the rounds. So, I assume almost everybody in the world knows of XKCD. But I think it's actually still the most recent one. It's called Emulation, and it basically, you know, shows somebody at their computer saying, you know, loading, please insert disk and drive A. And the guy says, there you go. You know, thank you, this disk is incredibly fast. Because, and the caption, you know, not the whatever you call it, the floating text, but the caption says, I feel weird using old software that doesn't know it's being emulated. Because, you know, it's like, oh my god, you know, like, how is this disc so quick? How is President Reagan? But anyway, I think it got shared around a lot in our circles because it's, you know, it's so us. Yeah. The hover text says, I laugh at the software as if I'm 100% confident that it's 2019. But it reminded me a little bit. So I'm sure we talked about this at the time and probably a couple times since, but... Mark Pilgrim at Kansas Fest 2014 did a little thing where he was he presented emulator detection. Basically, he wrote a program that would report what emulator it was running in. Like, it was an Apple II program that could detect the universe outside of it. Very interesting.
That's pretty amazing. How do you do that? Was some sort of timing analysis or certain things at certain places in the memory space? Or that's cool.
It's amazing. Yeah. So. I mean, he analyzed some of the various behaviors of the different emulators to do this. One of the things that he relied on for some of them, at least, had to do with how you write stuff out to disk. So disk images on a lot of these emulators were pretty underspecified. You know, they had just the data, not the like all the sort of address marks and timing bits and stuff like that that are actually on a real disk. And so the emulators would fill those in. But they would fill them in a consistent way, and different emulators would fill them in different ways. So that was part of what he was using, was just sort of detecting what the, you know, what the timing bits were, you know, or how many nibbles were on a track or something like that, in order to decide, like, okay, well, this is the, you know, whatever Apple Win emulator. But it's just magic, because, I mean, like, you know, it's a program that you could run on any computer, and it can tell, like, okay, well, this is real hardware, or this is Virtual 2 or whatever. It doesn't seem like it's possible, but he pulled it off, and it was, and I think everybody's jaw hit the ground. So, reminded me of that. Okay, let's see. So, next thing, I guess that's the end of the news. We have a couple of upcoming shows. I think they're upcoming still. Yes, okay, so WASFest 14.25045 megahertz. I think we announce these fairly regularly, and, you know, every time they go, I don't know if there actually was a 13. I'm not sure if this, but at any rate, the numbers go up, and then they try to think of some sort of like Apple II connection, and I forget what this is, but I think it's like the crystal speed or something that runs the timing. Does anyone know what that is? 14.25045?
Yeah. Do not know.
Anyway, somebody does. But anyway, it's in Sydney, November 23rd, 2019. It's actually it's kind of a little gathering, but we announce it because they tell us to. Also, two VCFs coming up. VCF Pacific Northwest, March 21st to 22nd in Seattle at the Living Computer Museum and Labs. And VCF East is coming up in Wall, New Jersey, April 24th to 26th. So some time to plan still. And I think last time we apologized for failing to even mention VCS, whatever it is, Midwest. What is that one?
Midwest, right?
I forget. Yeah. Okay, anyway, that's what we have on our list. If you have things we should announce, send them to us, and we probably will announce them.
Probably.
Yeah. And with that, a word from our sponsor.
You're sitting at your computer with your new QCAP from Radio Shack. Now you can access web pages even easier and faster than before. Just swipe the cat across a special Q code and watch the exact web page you want download right before your eyes. No more clicking through pages looking for specific information. Try it on the 2001 Radio Shack catalog, the world's first fully interactive catalog. And look for the Q codes in our monthly newspaper inserts. Faster, smarter. The QCAT, another innovative product to make your life easier. Available at Radio Shack.
Hi, love.
The average school child hasn't really changed much over the years. But school has. The computer has arrived. Under a government scheme, schools all over Britain are introducing microcomputers, and they're choosing one in particular, made by Acorn. As a result, the language it uses, called BBC Basic, has become the acknowledged computer language for schools. And now parents can catch up. For Acorn have produced a micro for the home that also uses BBC Basic. It's called the Electron. It's powerful, it's versatile, and it's only £199. So now your children can teach you all they know. The Acorn Electron can be found at larger W.H. Smiths or your local Acorn dealer. Just call 200-0200 for your nearest stockist.
And we're back. So, the host's retro computing gift idea, you might have heard us have this idea just earlier in this episode, but it is something from the team6502.org shop. We will suggest a MOS 6502 tote. It actually looks quite cool, I have to say. But so it is it's a tote bag. It says, you know, MOS. It shows a white ceramic 6502 and then says 6502. I don't really know why the dot is filled in, but I guess that's supposed to look like the MOS. Mm. But $22.50, you can get a shoulder tote. $22.30, sorry. 40% off with a code that ends today.
Oh.
But it may say that every day.
Yeah. What do you mean by today?
Yeah. Well, exactly. I do kind of wonder if this is like, you know, going on a business sale where it's just, in perpetuity?
Yes. It's a going out for business sale.
Right. Anyway, it looks cool. So if you wanted to get something to attract the attention of people wider than just the people who knew old Apple II software, you can get a 6502 bag. Maybe Carrington can get one of these for his other arm.
Making more friends. Look at me using plural on that, like a big optimist.
I like it. It's cool. So I think it's cool. This is hosted on the Zazzle site, but was this linked actually from the 6502 thing?
Yes.
Okay. Nice. I guess there's no reason that they need to also be able to make bags and things. But get this. Looks cool. And now we can turn to the eBay auctions. Carrington has done what I usually do and picked like 9 different things.
I picked all the things.
Yeah. So.
But I'm going to go through them really quickly. Eh, a bunch of things caught my eye. My suggestion, as usual, is don't buy any of them. I've shared the screen. We'll see if Earl's got the... Oh, look, he's got the screen up. Master man. So the first one is $99, buy it now, Apple Macintosh SE that may or may not be working. That's not why this is interesting. Why this is interesting is if you look at the little pictures, it comes with one of those swivel stands. Those things usually go for more than this auction's going for. So forget the SE. If you're looking for one of those swivel stands, which are outrageously priced on eBay for some reason, this might be a way to pick one up more cheaply. So you'll get an SE, you'll get rid of the SE, you'll modify it into not working,
right.
And you'll have yourself a stand. So if you're looking for a Mac swivel stand, this is a stealth way to get one. So that was my first choice.
Cool.
Yeah, it's pretty yellow. it's yellow.
But you'd retrobrite it or paint it or whatever. Also, these stands, I don't know why they shouldn't be as expensive as they are, because it's just a stinking stand. You should be able to find something else. Pop it up on a pile of books or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I had one of these stands when I was rocking an SE way back in the day, and I did quite like it. So I guess if I had an SE now, I would want one of them, but I don't know that I would spend $100 even on them, let alone this. So, Paul, do you have 4 or 5 of these?
I don't think I have any of the stands. I have many, many SEs. But...
Well, there you go. You got to get yourself many, many stands.
Right.
So that's my first choice. Buy it now. Don't buy it for the thing they're selling. Buy it for the thing that comes with the thing they're selling. Choice number two is what is claimed to be a new, never-used Quadra 650. We all know I like the Quadra 650. Here's one still in bag, but also comes with a box. So I'll show you the other pictures.
Oh, that's nice.
Look, yeah, exactly. So it is a very nice looking Quadra 650. There it is in its box. So I think the person took it out of the box. I think this probably was used and has been packed back up. But that said, this is probably the nicest looking 650 I've seen. So if you're looking for one, it's got 5 bits at the moment, 4 days to go. So it will already be over by the time you hear this. But for those of you watching us live on YouTube, hello, Abby, then this will be the reason why you want to watch us live on YouTube. You get to hear our fumblings, but you also get to snag the auctions that have expired by the time the audio comes out. So there's your reason. $290 is what it's up to now. I suspect it'll go higher. At $290, I think this would be a total bargain because it's a nice computer. Is this the one that you, the computer you tried to get, Paul, and that it arrived smashed?
No.
Was that 630?
Oh, what was it? Now I'm not remembering. It was one you recommended as being like, I don't know, I'm trying to remember what
I think that's the 630, the one that can be a whole bunch of different stuff and run the Apple II card and stuff. Yeah. So the 650 is a nice Mac II from that period, but it's more that just like if you want a 650, this is a really nice one. About the nicest I've seen come up on eBay. So.
I'm trying to remember I absolutely had a Quadra 650, like in my actual computer when was doing, you know, back when it was new.
There it is, beauty shot.
Yeah. and it has the CD caddy.
Yes. Love a caddy.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember that's right. I had this and then I don't think I converted it. I think I may have traded it for a Power Mac 7100.
Okay.
But
probably a good choice.
I liked it. Oh, I liked it. It was nice. So yeah, I have this nostalgia for it.
From the period of a nice, it's like got nice industrial design to it. You get both a CD and a floppy. So it's in that era where you're getting both of those. So it opens up a lot of gaming things for early Macs. It's not the greatest early Mac, but it's a nice one. And this is in very nice condition. And this has the kind of video out, like an RGB thing, or rather a regular VGA thing. So it's, as far as I remember, so it's very easy to hook this kind of Mac up to modern monitors. So pretty nice as an old gaming Mac. Next up, we have... Here we go. We've got the original QCAT. So that useless hand scanner thing. Here's a picture of the scanner. So remember this thing? Paul, how many of these do you have?
I think I've actually managed to avoid... Oh, maybe two.
Okay, so you see how it's shaped like a cat? The original QCAT is actually shaped like a little cat. That's its form factor. And you could use it to scan things in Wired Magazine. This is the one for Wired Magazine subscribers. So if you are a Wired Magazine subscriber, you could right away, I guess, and get this thing. This is the box it came in. I don't see these ones that often. Now, the thing about the QCAT, which I think it says in this auction, is it relied on software that kind of doesn't run on anything modern anymore that talked back to like a database that doesn't exist anymore. Ooh. So it makes this pretty much a useless product.
Well, actually, I've got a couple of these QCATs. And
do they work?
I never used them for what they were originally intended for. But what would happen is you'd scan a barcode and it would kind of go in line with your PS2 connector on your computer. So you'd get a bunch of bytes coming in, but they were mangled in some way. But somebody figured out how to reverse engineer it. So there was some software that would take the scan and then reverse engineer to what the actual contents were. So I was able to get it to work. So I could...
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. You know, that software, I'm sure it's got to be out there on the internet somewhere that somebody could use. And you also need a PS2 keyboard connector, not USB.
No, I don't.
But, well, you may not. But if you want a QCAT, you will.
I do not want a QCAT, so I don't. But it's just neat. I don't see a lot of these, like, still. It says sealed in box, and then has a picture of it outside the box. So people, they throw around the word sealed on eBay quite a bit. Uh-huh. It does not mean what you think it means. But I like this one because this is the QCAT that actually looks like a cat. It's a cute cat. Next up, we've got two auctions that are paired together. Because last time I did this whole theme, I think it was the last time where I picked a year. Was that the last episode? I don't know. I went through 1972. My theme for this time was supposed to be museum stuff. I just got distracted because sometimes there's fun keywords you can search on and find things just based on a weird keyword. And so this one, the keyword was museum. Sometimes you get museum quality, some museum items, whatever. And so we have a pair of two different auctions that are kind of related. One is this Altair 680, and it's a case. So it's not a full one. See, it's just a case. Look at that. Mm-hmm. It's case. So if you wanted to mod an Altair 680 and for some reason not destroy a real one, then here you go. You could just pick up this case for $100 and then stick any old thing in it and get yourself some blinking lights and whatever and feel like you didn't go and destroy a real one. So it was an idea. I don't know, because we're talking about modding. So are you guys going to buy it and mod it into things?
No, but it's so pretty.
It's really pretty, right? Because it's new. Like, it's super new. It's as new gets.
Yeah.
Now, these aren't lights. These are just holes drilled in the front of the case.
Yeah.
So, you know, supply all your own blinking lights. But Halloween just passed, but this would have made a very cool pumpkin. Stick some candles behind there, sticking out front. All the little retro nerds will come and be your friends. They'll say, "Do you have any tote bags?" You say, "Yes, I do." And you'll be friends and have marshmallows, and it'll be great. Just saying. That's how friends are made, apparently. So this is what you would buy for $100 if you wanted to mod the heck out of it and not have nerds mad at you. This next one is what you would buy for a little more money, $800, and mod the heck out of it if you want them to be mad at you. This is an actual Altair 680, and it's a museum demo. I don't know what that means. Why is it a museum demo? But it's the one that came up when I was searching on museums. It's in nice shape, so it's like, I mean, it's, look at that. What a nice looking 680. The 680 was not a useful computer then. It's not a useful computer now. This is my opinion. But this is a particularly nice looking one with all the little switches and all the little lights. This would make a really nice pumpkin, is what I'm saying.
I don't think it has. Does it? It may not actually have the computer in it. That may be with the demo part.
Oh, maybe. Is it? Does it show? Oh, look at that. That's about what came with the 680, I think. You're right. It is strictly little things that would light up. You would power it, and then those are going to light. You know, that's just as useful. I think if a lot of people had a 680 and they had this, they really wouldn't be able to tell the difference. It is an empty box. I love it. $800 empty box, which was, I believe, the original marketing slogan. Right. Next up, we have another two pair of ones that go together. The first is... Well, my keyword museum, a museum graphic. What makes it a museum graphic? I don't know. But it's this thing, this little graphic here, which I really like. See if we can zoom in on it. No, we can't. Sorry, dudes. But it's the Galavan computer, which was a portable laptop that failed portable laptop as opposed to his non-portable laptops. And it failed miserably. So this must have been one of their advertising things that showed how do you shrink like a big computer like this down to a little computer like that with a bunch of cute animals. I think it's an adorable print. And so it's nice. I think if you had a like a retro collection or something like that, you can see behind me that I don't. But for $200, buy it now. It's a really nice print and it's relatively large, 28 by 38 inches. So it's a neat little collector print. Now, are you guys aware of the Galavan laptop?
Not at all.
I've never heard of that before, no.
Exactly. So I went down a whole rabbit hole reading about it, and after reading about it, went back on eBay to see. I wonder, yep, there's actually one for sale at the moment on eBay, so I'll show you what it looks like. This is the Galavan computer. Looks like a case there, but hold on. We'll switch through to show it. Show the front. There, look at that. Big old keys, flip-up screen, and it was a complete failure. Somebody, John C. Dvorak, wrote, I'll put a link into it. On his blog, he wrote a nice article called Whatever Happened to the Galavan Mobile Computer, and talked about this thing that I'd never heard of before. So it turns out there's a fellow named, this came out in 1982. And so, I mean, look at this form factor. It looks like a modern type of flip-up laptop with a keyboard in front of a screen. I mean, this is, as John C. Dvorak says, this comes out at like the time when you've got maybe the Osborne 1 and you've got the Model 100 from TRC. You don't have laptops that look like this. Like, how could this be a failure? Well, a guy named Manny Fernandez, who was the president of Zilog, him and a fellow who was like the director of software from Zilog, John Banning, they left to found this company and put out this laptop. They recruited two former Apple programmers and three people from Xerox Palo Alto, Palo Alto Research Center, to put together this amazing computer, announced it, and because they were thinking, look at how well the Osborne 1 is selling, there must be a massive desire for portable computers. And Dvorak's thinking is they were misunderstanding what people really wanted from the Osborne 1, which was a cheap desktop computer, because it was bundled with such great software. It was kind of cheaper to buy the computer than just the software that came with it, and that was the real appeal. Now this has, down here in front, a touchpad. So there is a keyboard, a 16-line LCD screen, and then in front of it, a touchpad. Crazy that this thing came out in 82. But the thing is, it didn't come out in 82. It had major problems, and they couldn't get it out. And they couldn't get it out in, like, 83 either. Then they could barely get it out, I think, by June 1984. So you can imagine the marketplace had changed considerably by the middle of 1984 when this thing came out at many, many, many thousands of dollars. I think it was $4,000, $5,000, something like that. So it would be hard to push this as a $5,000 massive, heavy, lumpy laptop in 1984 versus in early 1982. Now, the thing is, I'd never heard of this laptop before. Company went under. They could barely sell any of these things. And the ones they sold, they couldn't really create any. So somebody bought up a big stockpile of parts from the public auction after the company went under. And then they used all those parts to assemble machines that they then sold for $800 in 1986, I think it was. And they opened locations to do this and had like 12 branches in 1986 selling computers they were putting together from parts they got from the going out of business auction from the company. So none of this was something I had known before. I found the whole thing remarkably fascinating. And right now it's buy it now for $1,334.99. And I think Paul should start a collection of these.
this is quite wild. Yeah.
But if you see a side thing, you see how thick this computer is.
Yeah.
But down here we've got a composite video out. I mean, it looks like a cool computer. It probably had a bunch of neat tech in it. Just, you know, they misunderstood the marketplace and were 3 years too late to market, and I'd never heard of them because of it. So probably a fairly rare one. This is serial number 71 of the computer, so that might be the last one ever made. Who knows? Might be actually a very high serial number for this. I don't know. I thought it was a neat computer. It's one of the neat things about eBay. You start searching for weird terms, and you can go down a rabbit hole learning about computers you've never even heard of before. And I got one last auction to share with everybody. This is a fun one. It is a mainframe computer control panel for a big IBM mainframe, big metal thing with a bunch of buttons and switches. But this is super fun because of a particular part of it where it's got suppress punch button. So it's a little toggle to suppress punching. And I've got some friends, Quinn, I'm looking at you, that this would be awesome. I might bring this to Kansas Fest and I can throw the suppress punching switch and then she can't hurt us.
That's very cool.
Yep.
Also a switch I think to turn on and off the punch supply, I see.
Right, exactly. So it's a whole bunch of punching. It's just like, this is a cool thing. Like, this is a front panel. There was that, you know, the Altair 680 we just looked at, which would be kind of a neat box. Both of them turned out to be boxes to use as a project box. This would be a very fun project front end. Got a bunch of lights, got some neat switches, really cool labels. Having this as something that controls the light switches in your house or turns you to party mode or whatever, this would be fun. So I would like to acquire something like this as just a control panel thing. Problem is, it's in Australia and it's basically $500 and it's a big metal thing. So not something I'd be acquiring. But if Michael was here, maybe something he could pick up for himself.
Neat.
Very cool. All right. Yeah. And Earl, you have exactly one eBay auction.
I do.
The odd slacker.
And let's see if I can manage to somehow talk about the auction and share my screen and control the StreamYard all at the same time. I doubt it.
Ooh, we wish you luck.
So we're going to try, though. So this is what I was talking about when I mentioned an irreversible mod. My eBay auction is a Commodore 64 keyboard that has been both refurbished and had its aesthetic change. It's been painted green, and I actually think it's gorgeous. Let me bring up a big picture here. So this is from Darth Skalmar's Retro Garage, which is just an awesome name anyway. But if you look at the keys, you'll see they're painted green, but with a clear coat so that you can still see all of the letters and all of the pesky symbols and the key markings and everything like
that. It's a great-looking keyboard.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of vintage computer keyboards were kind of boring, both in terms of colors and layout. And honestly, you know, the Commodore 64 with just the beige color, it wasn't too attractive. I think this really, like, takes it up to the next level. The other thing that they've done with this keyboard in this auction is to refurbish it, cleaning all the contacts. If there were any rusted out springs, they've replaced them. So the keyboard is tip-top shape functionally, but also has this cool green look. So I'll cycle through some of the other pictures here.
Nice.
This really close-up, you can see that the key markings are really consistent. It doesn't look like it's washed out or splotchy based on the coloring that they've applied to these keys. So I think, you know, at least from these pictures, it looks like they did a really nice job. So this auction was $99. And I like it. And this is one of those mods that I would not regret doing or regret that somebody else did and then sold it to me.
Right.
These
practically look new. I mean, like, I wouldn't know that these weren't just, like, newly fabricated.
Yep.
Like, to me, I feel like most of the C64 keyboards that I've seen, I feel like the graphic symbols for what the graphics characters are kind of, like, not on the top of the key, but on the front. Or on the downside, were there just different models that some had
on the download?
Some had them on the top, like this also.
There were.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
I know what you mean, though. The keys on the graphic Petsky symbols on the front, as opposed to up underneath the letter. Yeah, it depended on the model.
Interesting. So, like the ones that had them on the top, like this, were these earlier ones or later ones, or?
You know, I could swear that the PET keyboard that I have. For the PET 2001, the 2001 model that I have isn't the chiclet. Mm-hmm. It's the one with that actual full-stroke keyboard. And I think the graphic symbols are on the front, if I remember right.
Anyway, it looks really cool. I actually also really love the color.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like tempted to click the button here.
Do it. Do it.
I mean, this is sort of irreversible. Like, this is fine. What it looked like before was probably terrible. So, although, I mean, I guess maybe
well,
not
that's
actually.
That's true, too. It could have been dirty, it, you know, could have been slightly discolored, and now it looks nice and new, and it functions nice and new, at least according
to the
seller.
It's such a fluorescent green. It looks like it would glow in the dark.
Now, that would be really cool.
Yeah, glow-in-the-dark paint would be cool on something like this. Get those newfangled light-up keys. Yeah, this'll do you.
I'm now just kind of puzzled by how, like, how this... Because aren't these keys brown, like, usually? So that, did they bleach them first, I wonder? Very weird. Anyway, whatever it is, it looks cool, and it would look cool on your Commodore 64.
Yep.
Maybe it's actually just magic.
Magic.
Okay, let's see. So I have a pile. For some reason, I've actually been fairly good, I think, in recent years to like not go all Apple all the time. But for some reason, I just caved in this time. So, and this is a lot of just sort of random things that seemed kind of interesting. But so the first one is, it's a set of four vintage Apple computing magazines from the 80s. And they're basically just sort of like pretty much random. So there is an A-plus magazine, which was, and it looks like that's the Apple IIc Plus there on the front. You know, so it's, oh, in fact, that's what it says. So it's from that era, kind of late Apple. There's a Two Alive magazine from 1994 about the Apple II and the internet.
Alive.
Yeah, so that's, I think that's pretty interesting, you know, pretty late. And then two Softline magazines, which were sort of like, I think it was by the same publisher who made Soft Talk magazines, but this was sort of game-oriented. So they have Bill Budge on the cover of one, and I don't know who's on the cover of the other one. But so it seems like if you're going to get four random magazines, these might be actually kind of cool. It's not very expensive. $12, buy it now. It's possible that I don't have any of these four. I'm sure that they're all scanned out there somewhere. But at any rate, if you are interested, there they are. So the next, there's a set of things that's actually being sold by this seller. I don't know offhand who this is, but anyway, same sellers for a couple of these things. This first one is, it says Vintage Original Apple II Personal Computer System Specification Booklet. And it's basically just a three-hole punched little booklet. It says Apple II on the front. And, oh, that's interesting. Actually, I've just flipped to the back. And the back, apparently it was up against an ad which had an iron-on on it that said Pascal spoken here. And you can see that the ink has kind of bled through. There was I forget where, there were maybe a couple of issues of Byte, I think, perhaps, that had this.
Yeah, but it's weird that it's not reversed.
It's reversed, yeah. It's reversed on the actual thing.
It should be a mirror image if it was against the ad and then pulled off.
Yeah, but the ad is reversed. If you go look at the ad, it like if you have the, if you're holding the magazine, you will see that the letters are in reverse.
Oh.
So.
Why was that?
So that they would be right side up when you applied it to the shirt, right?
Oh, it's a shirt.
So the ad was an iron-on shirt transfer.
Yeah, exactly.
So I missed crazy. That part.
But apparently this thing is...
This should increase the value.
I think it should, yeah. But okay, so let's see. We have, so it says Apple Computer 778-90M, which I think means that it was published in July 1978. 90M might be... How many they? I don't know. What I don't know what that indication is. I've seen that on a lot of these old documents, though. 1978, though, that's the important thing. This is really old. This is it's a little specification sheet that they sent out to people. I can't quite see how many pages it is, but it's probably something like 8 or something. Talks a little bit about the basic and, you know, the memory and stuff in it. This is actually, it's got a starting bid of $20, basically. This is a real historic document, though. So, unless nobody notices this, you know, I suspect this would go for more. This is actually a pretty nice thing.
I saw you hover over the place bid button.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Hover?
Yes, I think we had this discussion once before. It went into hoovering and all kinds of things. But anyway, yeah, I think this is actually a fairly interesting and rare document. So I would not bid right away.
Are you going to get it? Are you going to scan it? Are you going to make t-shirts out of it?
I don't know. If I do bid on it, I'm going to snipe it. I'm not going to bid now. it's possible, actually, that there's a chance that this episode will go out before the thing ends. We'll see.
Well, the YouTube video certainly will.
That's right. So, so Carrington has found the Pascal Spoken Here t-shirt ad. Let me see if I can make it come up on my,
I want the shirt.
Yeah. I don't know if I've seen, I think there's, somewhere there's actually a picture of somebody wearing the shirt, looking very 1970s. But anyway,
Pascal was such a weird thing. Like, it's a language, but it was also an operating system. And
yeah.
I like the language, but it's a weird OS.
Okay, let's see. So, historical booklet. The same seller has another thing, which I think is actually kind of rare. This is a Apple user group newsletter. So Contact was the name of it. It was a little publication that they made. I think there were probably 8 or 9 of them before it got folded into just basically part of a magazine called Apple Orchard. But so this is a sample demo issue of Contact 5. And I think that's interesting because, you know, Contact 5, all of these issues are relatively rare. I mean, they're 1979, basically. So there weren't many of them. The Apple community was fairly small. But this is not only Contact 5, this is like the sample edition. So probably extra rare. $20 buy it now. I've not decided to buy it, but I could.
What's fun about this is I spent a lot of time in publishing, weirdly, but through coupons, through a family business. Mm-hmm. So and did a lot of hand paste up of stuff. And absolutely, that's how this was done. It's so neat to look at something and go, this is done before desktop publishing.
Yeah.
This was done as hand paste up and stuck on things. And then you'd take a shot of it to make negative and make the plate. So it's kind of neat to see something made by a very large company, but that was clearly done using paste up stuff.
Yeah.
Cool.
Though it wasn't very large then. Really. I mean, this is before the disk drive, even. So I think Contact, maybe it isn't quite before the disk drive, but I think Contact 2 was the one that had the announcement of the disk 2 on it. So anyway, interesting sort of old things. And continuing in my looking at old Apple stuff, there's not a particularly nice edition of Apple II Business Graphics, but I felt sort of bad about it. You know, I felt sort of like I pitied it a little bit. So I, you know, because it looks nice. But, I mean, realistically, who would want the Apple II Business Graphics box? You only want it to collect it because it looks nice and it's old. But it is nice. I mean, they made these sort of nicely boxed up things. And I thought this was at least a sort of an interesting example of one of these things. I don't know that anyone would ever actually use it for anything, but there you go. Its starting bid is $10, so it's not a lot of investment for something that you probably would just put on your shelf.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have only one of these.
Only one? Paul, what are you doing?
You gotta fix that.
I have a fair amount of these things, and they do need preservation, you know, but at the same time, I don't think once it's preserved, anyone's really going to use it, except just to see how it worked, and then that'll be it. You know, there will be 3 uses post-2019 total. Okay, what else is here? Oh, yeah.
Oh, this next one is brilliant.
Yes, the way I called it was in the show notes was instant infestation. It is 30 Apple M0100 mice, but they're all very nice looking.
All look brand new.
Yeah, they might actually be. They're unyellowed, which is interesting. Yeah, they look totally new. I don't know why they're unyellowed, because they should be, right? I mean, they're gray. We know that there are many, many different flavors of MO100.
From that...
from Charles Mangan's talk.
Yeah, exactly. So that's how I learned, like, that number doesn't narrow it down at all.
Yeah.
But these are totally the platinum color, and they look brand new.
It's not super cheap, but, I mean, there are 30 of them for $200.
So is that like DB9 version? So which of the Macintoshes would this connect up to?
I think it would probably connect up to the very first one, the 128, and it would work on the Lisa as well. And Apple IIs.
This was an odd color then, if it's the platinum color and it was aimed at those computers.
Yeah, well, so this might have been actually for the first Mac, maybe. I don't know. I know I got one of these that was this color scheme for the Lisa. Like when I was when I bought Alisa 2, but it didn't have a mouse, so I bought a mouse, and it doesn't look like it fits quite color wise. But
you have only one. You don't have 30.
I did not have 30. I might actually only have one of this color.
But, oh, Paul, yeah. You must be tempted then.
Yeah. Anyway, pretty cool. Let's see what's next. Oh, okay. So this one, this is the same seller actually as Carrington. You had a couple of these. Vintage Computer Museum. I have yet to make up my mind about this seller. However, it says Rare Apple Logo Writer Software. Never used. And this caught my attention because I knew people were looking for this. Like, Logo Writer is something that, it's like something that people don't have for some reason on the Apple. So I thought, oh, geez, I should buy this. Rather than talk about it on, you know, this big public forum. But when I looked at the pictures, it seems like it is actually, I mean, the disk that we see and the manuals that we see say MS-DOS computers. But what it is basically an interface for the Lego stuff. So there's a TC logo that you can get for operating the Lego things on an Apple II. And this is a different, basically just like a different platform. So I think it might still be Logo based. I mean, it's called Logo Writer, but it's not quite the same. I think if this was the Apple one, this is something that, you know, somebody should get, possibly me, but
it's not though. I don't see the word Apple anywhere on it.
Right. So nowhere in any of the photos does it say Apple. In the title, it says Apple. The description says this package has never been used, only open for pictures. So I guess I would assume that the pictures that we have are the pictures of the thing. Mm-hmm. So it's the MS-DOS one. And I don't think that one is, like, I think that one is not lost. So, however, if you know differently and are listening to this and it's still available, it actually is kind of cheap if it is something lost like that. So, anyway, I guess I'm just sort of saying this to the world in case someone out in the world recognizes
Hello,
this
world.
Is something that we need. All right. Shall I keep going?
Yes.
Only a couple more.
Do it.
So this is the next thing I picked is an Apple MIDI interface. And I picked this partly just because I thought, you know, I've never used MIDI for anything, and I can't quite figure out if I would. But I kind of want to. So have any of you used MIDI for anything at all?
I'll answer on behalf of everybody. No.
I have a long time ago, mm-hmm. back when I had an Atari ST, and like that was one of the features that it had built-in MIDI ports. It's one of the things you could do, like you could chain them together to play a game called Mini Maze, which was like this like 3D sort of maze hunt thing, finding each other in a maze.
Huh.
I did that once, and I had a MIDI keyboard that I could use as input to like a sequencer program that I used very, very little.
My problem is I'm biased against MIDI because I know what it really is an interface thing. So you can hook it up to sequencers and keyboards and like run real band stuff and make amazing music. Mm-hmm. But my experience with MIDI are you download little MIDI song files and you play them on your computer and it's like really bad versions
of music. Yeah.
Beep, boop, boop,
yeah.
And so when I hear MIDI, I just think, oh, it's that terrible sounding music stuff.
Well, that's general MIDI. General MIDI was a definition of sounds for like this channel number equals this instrument. And then like, depending on what kind of sound card you had from the 90s onward, it would sound uniformly always terrible, but like somewhat different from computer to computer, different between Windows and Mac. And like, probably you can play those probably natively on a modern Mac also with some built-in thing. It probably sounds better than it did back then, but probably still not good.
Hmm.
I remember trying to use MIDI for some music type applications. I had a keyboard that supported it, but one of the problems I always tended to run into, if I remember right, this is a long time ago, but it seemed like there was a lot of latency, which you kind of wouldn't expect in a musical sort of situation because, you know, timing's everything with music, right? So it was very frustrating. I don't know if it was just my computer that was messing up or something, but I never had a very good experience with it either.
Do you remember what kind of computer or OS you were using?
It was a PC compatible of some sort with Windows.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably the problem is Windows. Like, no, honestly, like Windows in the past especially was notoriously bad at latency for any kind of like audio production software. It was just a joke. It's probably better now. It's probably totally fine now. But like, if you're talking back in the 90s or early 2000s, like it was just not architected for that at all. It just did not compute.
Yeah, that's probably what it was then.
Yeah, and I guess I keep kind of wanting to do something with this, but I don't feel like I have, I don't know, like I can't play the piano really. And so I bought at some point a relatively famous, I'm trying to remember even what is the brand, a PX7, something X7. There's a well-known
Yamaha
DX7.
DX7,
yeah.
DX7, yeah. That sounds right. It's kind of like a middle of the road synthesizer. So
MIDI of the road.
Right. But it's sort of like it's professional enough that you could use it to play a show. You know, it's not just like a little Casio thing sitting in
your bedroom. No, lots of bands used the DX7.
Yeah.
So I got a it's something else X7, which is like maybe it's a CX7 or something. It's basically like the generators but without the keyboard, so that I could actually plug this into something and get like that kind of, you know, DX7 sounds out.
Right.
But that's as far as I got. So I saw this and I thought, well, that'd be interesting. This particular one that I'm linking to has it works on both like old Apple II GSs and Macs.
Okay.
Like early Macs. So anyway, I don't know why I picked this next one, but the next one is I guess it looks nice. It's a Deck Professional 350, and I've been kind of curious about these. I don't know very much about them.
You picked it because it's awesome.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. The Pro 350. It's basically a PDP 11 compatible system in the form of a desktop, and it has choices for the operating system that you run. And I love the look of it. You know, that floppy drive kind of reminds me of a Deck Rainbow, that little
right.
flip up, flip down sort of. And the keyboard in this auction, I noticed, looked just a little grungy, but the system works. They powered it up. They tested a few different things. They show you the photos. This was, man, if this was closer to me, it might already be bought.
Yeah, well, that was when I looked at it, that was part of what I was thinking was that it works. It looks very complete. You know, I've kind of kept an eye out for these things before and not, I haven't seen anything that looks quite this good. I mean, certainly not working, you know, half the time the disk drive's missing or, and I think these are weird drives too. I think these drives are, like nothing else. So you have to get that specific kind.
The drives even look weird, like on the front of it, like you're saying it's a flip up, flip down thing.
Yeah, it's
weird. Because it's kind of got a round part in the middle and those little notches there. It looks like a player piano roll, which is a great way to bring data in. I would be all over it if that was the case.
This is, it's very nice. It has manuals. It's not expensive. It's a $300 starting bid, but it is, you have to be in Tucson. So if you are in Tucson, perhaps that is the thing for you. Let's see. And then the very last thing I have... I wasn't going to list this, but we were talking about something. I think it was the Mac, the swivel stand. I was saying it looked very yellow, and I was reminded of this auction, which has some of the most yellow computers I've ever seen.
Oh, my goodness.
They're really just amazing. So this particular auction, let me go back to the description, is $2,000 starting bid. It is in Burnsville, Minnesota. It is just a tremendous amount of stuff. I'm not convinced that it is too much for what this costs, but these are all in amazingly bad sort of color shape. So there's this opening thing has an Apple III and an Apple III Plus with a profile drive of unknown size, but I mean, already those things are, the Apple III Plus in particular is pretty expensive and rare. Little RAID array of floppy drives. And a various source. This really totally just looks like my office. Oh, and a PC 8300.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
And a hard drive. You can see there on the side here, the hard drive at the bottom has, I mean, it's like a caramel colored by now.
It's like this person cooks with a lot of turmeric or something. Like, this is crazy yellow.
That is really, yeah.
Ooh.
There you go.
But also a bunch of laptops, a bunch of, there's a lot in this auction.
Yeah. So
does it say if the Apple 3s are working?
I don't, let's see. Oh, I didn't see these. Yeah. Unbelievable. So this is basically just someone cleaning out the basement. Mm. Oh, look at that. See, those look like my SEs.
In fact, this is somebody selling Paul stuff. Okay, I'm the one hosting this auction.
Wow.
Have you checked your office lately, Paul? Have you seen
it? Okay, so actually, this thing that I'm waving the mouse around, I think that might be a swivel stand. Anyway, that is, it's whatever it is. It's amazingly brown.
It's yellow enough to be one. I think you're right. I think that's a swivel stand from above.
Yeah.
But even, in fact, there's two of them.
Yeah, and one is quite not as bad. But
right.
Okay, so
one mustard, one caramel.
So it doesn't say anything about things working. It just kind of gives odds. It's like, well, surely something here must work.
Surely something.
I think, this, it will not ship. You have to go to Minnesota to get it. You will need a small box truck or a very large van to carry it away.
If you got this for $2,000, you could get your money back piecing this out, I think, no problem.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff here.
Right.
And Televoice stuff and Mac 86 things. But it would be a lot of work to get that money back. But certainly, summer hobby, you could do this and be net positive.
Yeah, I think that's true. And you could conceivably even improve things a little by retrowriting or whatever, conceivably. I don't know. Some of this, I have really never seen anything quite as yellow as some of these things. It's really
But they got
amazing.
A lot of cool, like, duo dock things.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of, every time I look at these photos, I keep seeing another neat thing in this collection.
Yeah. It's interesting. If you're somewhere near Minnesota, then you can check this out. But okay, enough of this. I think you've spent enough money on eBay.
Enough of this.
We can now return to, I guess we're at the closing discussions point, which is good because, we're over an hour and a half by now.
Yeah.
Sure.
I wonder if anybody's watched us do this.
I pity.
Yeah. We had somebody at the beginning. At any rate, we are at the closing discussions. Carrington, you are alphabetically first. What is your...
Oh, okay, sure. I have shared my screen. Only thing I'm going to talk about is my mug that I've been drinking from since it's a video thing. This, my girlfriend who lives in Canada, so you wouldn't know her, she got me these mugs from a place called Calamityware, or a site called Calamityware, and they're great. So it looks like classic blue mug thingy. I don't know if you're seeing the mug or the screen. They sell plates and fabric and a whole bunch of things, and it's from obviously the ceramic collection, and it's these mugs here, and there's a set of four that I got, and I highly recommend them. So this is what they look like. So they look like classic, beautiful, normal sort of ceramics, but when you zoom in, you see
that's super cool.
It's monsters and people fleeing them and people being eaten and robots attacking and giant fish and it's just giant frog and things from the sky and people being carried away and pirate ships and it's amazing. So very classic looking ceramics, but with just adorable and hilarious things printed on them. So it's from a site called Calamityware. Strongly, strongly recommend them. They're great and they bring me joy every morning with my tea. couldn't be happier with a set of mugs. So.
I love those because they really do look like, something that would be in like your grandmother's cabinet or something.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, I think these ones in particular are based on, there's a particular, like this style of ceramic has a bunch of classic patterns that get repeated, and I think there's one about a couple that want to get married, but they're chased kind of around in a circle and eventually turn into birds. Like, it's some weird story. And I think this is based on that particular one, but instead of just being chased by a wizard and turning into birds, it's like people being chased by robots and fire and Bigfoot and dinosaurs, and it's amazing. Like, just there's so many details, just delightful. And there's a whole bunch of different stuff. And so the site's called calamityware.com, aptly named, and highly recommended.
Very nice.
Excellent. Earl, do you have any closing thoughts?
Just one, that I was with Randy Kindig on Floppy Days recently talking about the Epson HX20, and it was really fun chatting with him about it. And it also prompted me to drag out my HX20 and play around with it a little bit. I did discover it had a little bit of closet rot of its own. The capacitors apparently get old and they make the LCD screen look weak. And so if you want to fix it up, you got to pop it open and recap it. So we'll see if I decide to work up the courage to savage my HX20 motherboard and try and replace the capacitors. But anyway, it was a fun show. Always fun chatting with Randy, and was also kind of a nice prompt to get me to do some retro stuff. Another thing that I did recently was I have a Commodore SX64, one of those portables, and the keyboard had degraded to the point where it was almost useless. A lot of the keys were stubborn. If you hit them too hard, you get triple characters. So I decided to refurbish it. It's tricky because on that keyboard, there's a membrane that attaches to the printed circuit board. If you want to clean it, you got to peel off that membrane, but it's really fragile. So doing it is kind of like, you know, brain surgery. You got to be really careful or you're just going to kill your keyboard. Somehow I managed to not kill the keyboard and I got it back together and now it's like new. So yay,
cool.
I was very happy. I did a refurbish without destroying the thing that I was trying to refurbish.
Nice.
Yeah, I have I've yet to even begin to diagnose this, but I have an SX64 also that the keyboard doesn't do anything. Like, it's as if it is not plugged in.
Well, if it's completely broken like that, do you think it might be the cable?
Right. Well, that's what I'm thinking that might be it, you know, but at some point I want to look into that because I like it. I mean, I think it's kind of a neat way to use a Commodore. If you need to use a Commodore, then this is a good way to do it.
Then you're wrong.
But it's got a cool little color screen and it's a nice thing. But right now it's just been sitting on my shelf because you know, I can't type on it. The screen works though. So it does start and.
Yeah, and the bummer of it is, you know, it's got kind of standard DB25 connectors on it, but the way that the connector on the computer part is recessed, some DB25s won't actually fit up into that little recessed port. So, yeah, it's a little tricky, but, you know, the internet has answers for you.
Yeah, I think I've seen some discussion of, like, do you sort of, like, have to shave off the edge in order to make it fit?
Yeah, just haul out the Dremel. It's all good. That's my motto, anyway.
Haul out the Dremel. All right, let's see. Jack, any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I don't really have any other retro thoughts going on right now.
I was going to mention this before and forgot, but Mike Whalen has an interesting podcast which has probably reached critical mass at this point. There's enough episodes that he thought it might be worth mentioning, and now since I think we hadn't mentioned it before, I will mention it now. It's called Retro Reads, and basically what he does is finds just sort of interesting things and reads them. So it's retro computing related. But and I admit that I am not caught up on it, but there's a lot of interesting stuff here. So if you know, if you are commuting or driving or whatever and can't actually like read the articles about, you know, whatever, the PT boat in the DAC winter catalog or whatever it is, you know, Mike will have picked something interesting and we'll read it to you.
Cool.
He and we had him once or twice on the RCR as well, so he is an alum of a sort.
Oh, and by the way, TRCWM on YouTube mentions, yes, we're still watching.
Oh,
so
cool.
Somebody's eyeballing us, and we give you our most humble apologies.
Excellent. The only other note I had, episode 200 just made it out onto the feed, so hooray. We are now recording 202. 201 is still on my hard drive. But hopefully these will both come out fairly soon. The other note I had was... I'm not sure this is just me, you know, griping in the show notes about something that was bothering me today. But so podcasts, you know...
I've heard of them.
In a sense, you know, the way people often listen to podcasts is you get a little thing and it will sort of stream it to you. And then it's gone. And the way most podcast apps work, they just assume that you will always be able to download a podcast. And of course, that is not true. We know that is not true. there are a lot of podcasts that no longer exist at the endpoint that they used to be at. And so I would like to be able to download them and keep them. And at some point, so iTunes used to be able to do that, and I used to work with iTunes doing that. And at some point, I don't know what it was exactly, you know, but there was something, you know, some flag got changed or whatever, and iTunes deleted everything. You know, it's like, great, you know, it's, many of these things are no longer downloadable. So they're just either in my backups or just gone. And I think at least some of those were just gone. So then I searched around trying to find an app that would do what I want, and it seems like they don't exist really. So what I want, world, is something that I can run on a Mac connected to a big hard drive that will download the things, you know, and keep them so that I can play them again later.
Yeah, that doesn't sound that complicated.
It doesn't. It seems like, I don't understand why this doesn't work, but it seems like almost every app out there believes that the solution to, you know, not having the podcast on hand is to download it again.
Mm.
Well, I'll even go one step further. I would love for a system to let me download my podcasts and keep track of my progress across devices. So if I'm on my smartphone, I'm listening to a podcast, I stop it in the middle, then I come in, I want to play it on my computer, but I want to start right back up from where I left off. And I want to keep it forever, like you're saying. I'd love to be able to do all of that. And yeah, to Carrington's point, that doesn't sound complicated at all. Somebody get on that.
What's weird to me is it seems like that's what everybody should want, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that sounds like
who listens to podcasts?
The most straightforward use case.
So a lot of the apps will do syncing like that, like what you're talking about, like, you know, remember across devices, even across Android and iOS. But basically, there's only one that I've really had that really seems to kind of do what I want, which is Downcast, I think is what it's called. And it's got a Mac client, and it, you know, it will download things and keep them forever. But the development is kind of stalled, and the application is pretty inefficient. It's, I don't know, you know, it's just sorting lists, but it must be sorting lists in the most inefficient way possible, because it eats up my battery and crashes all the time. And, the thing I just don't understand is why there isn't another one that I can turn to.
Well, maybe...
Yeah, I have this problem with BBC podcasts. Yeah. I listen to a lot of BBC stuff, and often it's available for a limited time. So only the latest one or two episodes are available. So once it vanishes, it'll say, oh, it's available online. I'm like, not for those of us outside the UK, or only for a certain time or whatever. Yeah. So those in particular are ones that I would like to just download and save.
Yeah, you're right. The... Car Talk used to be like that a bit, and there's, I forget what it's called, but there's some sort of, like, you know, Friday comedy thing or whatever on BBC that, you know, does that exactly what you're talking about. You have like one or two, and then that's it. You know, even better, Downcast does not do this, but even better would be if it would collect it and then let you play it, you know, stream it to you itself, you know, like, so you didn't have to, you know, like, I guess basically I have them on my hard drive due to Downcast, but I can't play them on my phone somewhere else.
Mm.
You know, it's not.
Yeah, in a sense, it would work better as like an online thing.
Yeah. So Plex needs to
write
do
it up
this.
In Perl or whatever, just to dump it to your own server and go there. Now I'm going to subscribe to my version of it, and that thing is subscribed to your version of it.
So kind of like a combination of Plex and a podcast app, or something like that.
Yeah. So if anyone out there works for Plex, you know, pressure them into getting this to work, because it's
pressure
it
them.
Seems to me like it's built for this, but yet they've introduced podcasts, but they have not introduced serving them.
Right.
Like you cannot download the media to your server. You can only download it to your
client. A lot of times ads and things are, especially nowadays, are inserted on the fly, so they want you to stream it every time. So every time they're keeping track of the clicks and the links and the downloadies, and they'll get all the stats and that sweet, sweet podcast money. And also then you get those terrible ads thrown at the front of your podcast that are volume way different than the thing you're going to actually listen to.
Cool.
Ads are terrible. Down with consumers. Don't buy anything.
It was actually kind of interesting when I was when I would be in Montreal sometimes, you know, I would get different ads stuck on the front because it knew I was in Canada. So suddenly I've got Canadian ads for like Fido and stuff.
Ugh, those are the worst.
But anyway, okay, so that was my you know, closing shot. I guess it's sort of podcast related at least.
Sure.
But anything else? All right, so that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss this in the forums at bcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. And if you'd like, you can write a review on iTunes. And that's it. And then this other part that we do. And until next time,
Retro-compute!
That's cool. I forgot about that part, actually.
I bet you want to.